Welcome to Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. Hello, Chicago, and welcome to another enrapturing episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. Coming up on today's podcast, we have an interview with James Sherman, the playwright behind the new show at the Victory Gardens, Half and Half. We also have two more audio reviews for your listening pleasure. And of course, as always, we have Chicago's theater news. So sit back, relax, and get ready to talk some theater. Hello, Chicago, and welcome to Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of June 12th, 2006. Well, the Jeff Citation Awards were held last Monday. 37 awards honoring the excellence in non-equity Chicago theater were spread among 24 productions and 20 theaters at the 33rd Annual Festival. First-time nominees Infamous Commonwealth Theater walked away with many awards, including Outstanding Director and Production of a Play. And also Bailiwick Repertory Theater's Kiss of a Spider Woman received the award for Outstanding Production and Director for a Musical. Congratulations, Infamous Commonwealth Theater and Bailiwick Repertory. For a complete list of the recipients, check out Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. I'd also like to say congratulations to Lifeline Theater for their adaptation of Johnny Tremaine, who won for Best Adaptation. And as many of you may remember, Dorothy Milne from Lifeline Theater was our first interview here on Talk Theater in Chicago. Congratulations, Dorothy. We knew you had something special. Well, the success of Chicago's open-ended run of Wicked continues to shows in many, many formats. The Chicago Company earned the top fundraising honor in the 20th annual Easter Bonnet Competition. The competition is a national effort on behalf of the charity Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. The awards ceremony held in New York City announced that Chicago's Wicked was the top fundraiser in the category of productions outside of New York. Congratulations, Wicked. They raised over $227,000 for the charity. This will mark the second consecutive win for Chicago's Wicked. At the last holiday season, they took first place in the Gypsy of the Year fundraising drive. Well, it seems that despite all the objections about the smell of that wonderful caramelly and cheesy popcorn emanating from Garrett Popcorn Shops, a new store is definitely going to be opened in the Theater District, and more appropriately, at the Oriental Theater. Many attempts had been made to stop the opening of the wonderful smelling shop by the owners of the building, claiming that it would distract the employees. Wonderful smells distract people all the time, I definitely understand that, but a local county judge seemed to disagree and hammered out a ruling that Garrett's Popcorn could definitely open in the Oriental Theater. Congratulations, Garrett Popcorn. Be sure to stop by when it opens and buy a few bags. And speaking of announcing theater seasons, Chicago Children's Theater has announced their first full theater season. It's going to start off with Ray Bradbury's Dandelion Wine, and get this, it will be directed by About Face Theater's Eric Rosen. I definitely don't want to miss that. Following that will be a collaboration with the Dutch company Ish, and a show called For Ish. The show will feature hip-hop, kung fu, and dance moves. Coming in next summer, Sean Graney will be directing for the CCT. Honus and Me, Stephen Deitz's play about a baseball card, and a little kid. That will be coming to the Goodman Theater. For more information about all of this, check out www.chicagochildrenstheater.org. Again, that's Chicago Children's Theater, with an R-E, .org. Talk Theater in Chicago would like to congratulate Hallie Gordon for being named the new artistic director for Theater on the Lake, that is run by the Chicago Park District. Gordon was previously the managing director of Theater on the Lake, and she will be replacing Kurt Columbus as the new artistic director. And as many of you know, Kurt Columbus is heading over to the East Coast to be the artistic director of Trinity Rep. We wish him much luck there. And we also wish you, Hallie Gordon, much luck on being the new artistic director for Theater on the Lake. We look forward to some great things from you. Eclipse Theater Company has announced their new featured playwright for the 2007 season. Pearl Cleage will be honored in the One Playwright, One Season extravaganza held by Eclipse Theater Company. Pearl's plays will include Blues for an Alabama Sky, Hospice, Late Bus to Mecca, and Bourbon on the Border. You should definitely try to go see all these plays because, more than likely, you'll see Pearl Cleage there also. Well, thank you very much for listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast. Remember, we are here every Monday with more news ready for your ears. Until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.
Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's review podcast. Here's my review of Half and Half. Half and Half by James Sherman, directed by Dennis Zajac at Victory Gardens Theater. Half and Half equals 100% enjoyable play. James Sherman has penned many terrific plays, Beau Jest, Affluenza, From Door to Door, and The God of Isaac, among the many he has produced. And he is known as the Neil Simon of Lincoln Avenue, which is a terrific term that first coined by Sid Smith of the Chicago Tribune. He and Victory Gardens and director Dennis Zajac have collaborated to produce all but one of Sherman's plays. Their latest, Half and Half, is a smart-telling comedy that is actually two interconnected one-acts about married life. Sherman's work uses Chicago as a background and is filled with wit and biting humor. Half and Half covers one family living in the same Rogers Park house, first in 1970 and then in 2005. Set in a working kitchen set designed by Mary Griswold, we find Susan, played by Laura T. Fisher, as a frustrated, unhappy housewife who strongly wants to break away from the traditional mold of being a housewife. She becomes a feminist, a liberated woman who announces to her demanding and controlling husband, Stuart, played by Joe Dempsey, that she will march in the 1970 Earth Day demonstration. After Stuart orders her not to and further orders her to stay home and cook and clean, she revolts, leaving a baffled Stuart unable to cope with the sudden events. Sherman has a handle on this era, aptly depicting the turmoil that often accompanied such liberating transitions. Lucy, played by Maddie Hawkinson, is the daughter who strongly embraces the modern feminist ideals of her mother. In Act Two, in the same house, 35 years later, we see Lucy, who is now grown up, played by Laura T. Fisher, who is now an attorney busy preparing a case for trial. Jeremy, her husband, played by Joe Dempsey, is a stay-at-home husband and sometimes novelist who cooks breakfast for Lucy in a time-appropriate role reversal that happens often in the world of the 21st century. Sherman smartly covers the drastic changes in marriage roles in only a generation. In the first act, Stuart is an unsympathetic male chauvinist, typical of his generation. Susan is the struggling woman whose self-worth needs more than cooking and cleaning to make her a woman. In Act 2, Lucy starts to act like an uncaring, career-oriented wife, while Jeremy plays the unappreciated homemaker, while their daughter Katie, again played by Maddie Hawkinson, is a typical teen of her era. She just wants a nose job. Sherman's intelligent writing suggests that a new role for each partner in a marriage may now emerge as both parties discover the common ground and meeting of each one's needs makes a marriage work. Marriage indeed is a partnership of equals, allowing men and women to communicate and to share the creation of an environment that fills everyone's needs. Just because now the women are taking on the men's roles and the men are taking on the women's roles doesn't mean that the same problems exist. I think that's a clever way of looking at it. Laura T. Fisher and Joe Dempsey do excellent work here as they capture their characters' angst and Lan Sherman's wicked comedy. There's some very funny bits of this. Half and Half is a cagey work that profiles the changes in the marriage model with a hint that the model still needs some refinement. This is a funny yet insightful cautionary tale. It is worth seeing, especially for the 30-something crowd. My rating on this show, recommended. It is at Victory Gardens Theater, which is 2257 North Lincoln in Chicago. The tickets run between $35 and $40. The running time is 2 hours with intermission. It runs through July 9th. For more information, call 773-871-3000. That's 773-871-3000. This is Tom Williams saying thank you for listening and go see a play this week. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's review podcast. Here's my review of Gaudy Night. Gaudy Night by Dorothy L. Sayers, adapted by Francis Lemcioni, directed by Dorothy Milne at Lifeline Theater. Gaudy Night is another delicious thriller from Lifeline Theater. Lifeline Theater presents Dorothy L. Sayers' detective novel, Come to Life with Gaudy Night. This is the third Sayers play from Lifeline Theater. Francis Lemcioni's snappy adaptation contains the flavor and spirit of Sayers' novels. These enjoyable shows keep audiences wondering whodunit throughout. With terrific ensemble work in impeachable British accents and a marvelously beautiful set by Jackie and Richard Penrod depicting the church-like arches of Oxford University in Britain. The campus is beautifully presented, particularly with the backdrops. Gaudy Night unfolds as a slick, polished production. Gaudy Night continues the adventures of the detective novelist Harriet Vane, played by Jennifer Tyler, and her friend, the aristocratic amateur sleuth, Lord Peter Whimsy, played by Peter Greenberg. The two met 5 years earlier when Whimsy saved Vane from the gallows as he proved that she didn't kill her ex-lover, Philip Boyes. Whimsy has been proposing to Vane at regular intervals since he first proposed at Newgate Prison during the trial. Gaudy Night, a term for the reunion at Oxford Scholars, finds Harriet Vane back at Oxford at Shrewsbury College, the first women's college at Oxford, and she's still avoiding marriage proposals from Lord Whimsy. Vane is asked by Dean Letitia Martin, played by Melina Monaghan, to stay on and help solve the mysterious acts of destruction that threatens and renders various faculty members in the college buildings. We meet the wacky women of Shrewsbury College, Mrs. Goodwin, played by Katie McLean, Mrs. Lingate, played by Jan Sodaro, and Miss Devine, played by Christiana Irwin, and Miss Hilliard, played by Mary O'Dowd, and add Annie Wilson, the maid, played by Kathleen Bentley, and there are many suspects to choose from. The play pokes fun at the unmarried female scholars and academics. The vandalism that's done is left with notes and threats and insults at the basically unmarried women who are part of the faculty here. Filled with notes, spooky events, Sayers' mystery is tough to solve. During Vane's investigations, which result in little more than a collection of letters and other obscene epitaphs, Harriet Vane encounters Lord St. George, played by Bradford R. Lunt, who is Peter Wimsey's nephew. Harriet learns much about Peter from this stuffy lad. Lynn is terrific as the stuffy British young gentleman. After endless frustration, Vane tries to enlist Peter Wimsey to help her solve the mystery, but he is on the continent on diplomatic missions for the British government. Eventually, Wimsey comes to the aid of Vane, and together they put the matter to rest. Gaudy Knight has humor, wit, and charm to spare. It surely is Jennifer Tyler's show, as she is a marvelously talented actress who deftly commands the show and exudes the warmth as the criminal novelist. She is terrific as Harriet Vane. Peter Greenberg's Lord Wimsey is equal to Tyler, and together the two have the chemistry that is electric and believable. These two have starred in all three of the Sayers novels that Lifeline Theater has produced. This entertaining show contains excellent ensemble work, flawless technical values, and a slick professional production that director Dorothy Milne always seems to mount. Lifeline Theater sure knows how to adapt literature and produce totally engrossing shows. They indeed infuse life into literary works. My rating on this show, recommended, it is at Lifeline Theater. The address is 6912 North Glenwood Avenue in Chicago. The tickets are $20 to $26. The running time is 2 hours 30 minutes with intermission. For more information, call 773-761-4477. That's 773-761-4477. And the show runs through July 30th. Thank you very much, and remember, go see a play this week. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Our guest this week is playwright James Sherman, who has had a long and illustrious career, particularly with plays that were first produced by Victory Gardens, since he is one of the playwright ensemble members. Jim has the 1989 hit Beau Jest, which is still the longest-playing show in the history of Victory Gardens Theater. Mr. Sherman's other plays include Magic Time, The God of Isaac, Mr. 80%, Affluenza, and we are here today to talk about his new play that just opened at Victory Gardens Theater, Half and Half. Well, hello, Jim.
Hi, Tom.
Well, tell us now about your latest endeavor, Half and Half, that just opened.
Well, I've been working on this play for about a year and a half, and a number of ideas kind of came together before I started writing it. I wrote a play a few years ago called Door to Door, which was very much inspired by my mother's life. And the first half of Half and Half was inspired by my mother-in-law's life, who was very involved with the women's movement in its early days, in the early 70s. She was also very involved with the first Earth Day as an environmentalist.
And so Act 1 of Half and Half starts out in 1970.
Right. The first act of Half and Half takes place precisely on April 22nd, 1970, which was the very first Earth Day. And in talking with my mother-in-law, I learned a lot about her story, not only about that particular day, but about her blossoming consciousness as a feminist. And I know from my own research, reading about Betty Friedan and women of that time, that a lot of women heard Betty Friedan speak or read The Feminine Mystique, and it was like African Americans hearing Martin Luther King speak. It changed their lives.
Yes, I do remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm old enough to, I was like 20-something at that time, yeah.
So the first act depicts what I wanted to do was depict this blossoming consciousness of this woman character. And she does indeed walk out the door, kind of like Nora in Doll's House at the end of the first act.
But the way you did it, I mean, the way she's at the beginning, she's cooking for him. And I love the set. We're here at the set, and they were squeezing orange juice and actually cooking. The stove works, huh?
Well, like most women of her day, she was a housewife and a mother, and that's really what defined her. And I thought, well, we need to see that part of her life. And I thought, well, the best place to do that is in the kitchen.
But as much as she didn't like doing it, she did do it because she knew it was sort of her obligation until she either got up enough guts or had just finally had enough.
Right. It was something she had done for many years and didn't know that she had any choices. And once that opportunity presents itself, she just had to take it.
Yes, she did. And now tell us about her husband, because he's a classical figure.
Well, her husband is very much of a man of his time, and it was a particular challenge to create that character because he is the archetypal strong, silent type, and a World War II vet, a child of the Depression, and very much a man who's accepted his role as a breadwinner and a husband and a father. And that's what he does, and that's all he can do. And unfortunately, at the time, while women's consciousness was being raised, it didn't raise for the men that well.
No, it didn't. And at intermission, many of us were talking about how it struck home.
Right.
Now, the women, a lot of the older women in the audience, it was kind of their story, or they knew someone very much like the liberated lady, but... I knew a couple of fathers, of friends of mine, that were just like him. Yeah, sure. They didn't talk much, and they ended up ordering things around. They didn't want change.
They didn't. They didn't know how to change. They didn't have that in them.
Yeah, they were. I guess they ended up being the male chauvinist pigs. The term came later, I guess.
Well, that's where the term came from, and it's unfortunate because they weren't bad guys. They were doing what they knew how to do.
And I think you captured that, and I think Joe Dempsey did, and Laura T. Fisher was just, she's so good.
Yeah, I couldn't be happier. It's just been a wonderful cast, and this is my first time working with them, and it's just been a joy.
Well, but this isn't the first time you've been working with Denis Zajac.
No, this my relationship with Denis goes back more than 20 years now. The first play I did at the Victory Gardens Theater was The God of Isaac, which opened in 1985. So it's been a long time.
Oh, you've been at this for a while.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And a lot of you folks, you realize that James Sherman is known. Sid Smith gave you a great nickname. You should be proud of that. The Neil Simon of Lincoln Avenue.
I don't mind that.
Because you find that's nice company to be in. Only the most successful playwright in the history of the world.
Well, you know, I started in the business as an actor and began my professional career working with the Second City. So comedy has always been the palette from which I work.
But you work Chicago-based and kind of very family comedy, and almost kitchen sink comedy, but almost a unique style.
Well, I'm an old-fashioned kind of guy, and what's unique about it is I think I'm the only one who's doing it anymore.
Well, that makes it unique. So sometimes old-fashioned can be unique.
I think so. I think so.
Well, I think you make it work because people can really relate it. As I said, at the intermission of the play, a lot of people were upset in a good way. It brought back the kind of memories they didn't want the men were. Yeah, that could have been them, or their father went through it. And to me, it was where is this going? Because... Mm-hmm. It's a comedy, but, you know, we don't really like what's going on here. And so tell us about Act Two, because Act Two is totally different.
Act Two is quite different, although it takes place on the same set in the same house. It's 35 years later. And the other thing that inspired me about writing this play is that I'm a married person myself and a father, and I am often aware of how different I am as a husband and father than my father was as a husband and father. So in one generation, roles for husbands and wives has changed so much. So it was that change that I wanted to depict in the second act.
Well, you certainly did. And you're right. That's another thing that gets alluded to in plays, but no one's really dealt with it kind of head on the way you did.
Mm-hmm. And
so set up Act Two now.
So Act Two, the couple in the first act has a 15-year-old daughter. So the second act is that daughter now grown up. She's been raised by this feminist, so...
So like she's a total women, feminist from...
So, yeah. Completely. So like a lot of women of our generation, she has taken the freedom of choices that she's had. She's gone to law school, and now she's the breadwinner, and the husband is the stay-at-home dad, who is very in touch with his feelings, the complete opposite of the man in the first act, even though it's played by the same actor.
Yeah, that was brilliant. A couple of people wondered... You know, and Laura T. Fisher plays Lucy grown up, too.
Right.
Which was the right casting choice to do. But it's funny how a couple people I heard behind me, oh, they're the same. Oh, that's the one grown up. I mean, right. It was pretty obvious. But
yeah, it takes a while to figure it out.
But you see the range of the actors, too.
Yeah, they're just wonderful. And so it gave me an opportunity then to explore how these roles have changed, how sometimes we might yearn for the good old days and maybe want to go back to the way things
because
were.
Because we see the husband, he's now cooking, and he's a stay-at-home, right. Sometimes novelist?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And is that a little bit similar to your background, although you use novelist?
Somewhat, yes. And I'm not actually a stay-at-home dad, although because I am a writer, I am home a lot more than my father used to be, who was a businessman.
But how true that is in the 21st century, there are a lot of, I know a number of them.
Oh, yeah.
Where the wife is the, and they say in the generation coming up now where law schools and med schools are dominated by women, it's even going to be much worse. There'll be a lot of men staying at home. And
right.
You know.
And that's another thing that I'm able to explore is for the women. While there have been great strides made for thanks to the women's movement and feminism, we're still not all the way there yet.
No, we're not. And that's the clever part. You did it in a poignant way and a funny way, because we like the stay-at-home father.
Mm-hmm.
He's a good guy and he's trying real hard to please. And I figured, well, is he heading down to just being total opposites? But you didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then was this going to go and just flatten out, or was it? Were you going to emerge into the look at maybe there's a middle ground, or we're still emerging in this?
Well, I think the main difference between the two couples is in the first act, because of who those characters are, they're not able to ultimately connect to find the connection that's going to keep them together.
And yeah, you just know. You don't show up, but you just know they're going to break up.
Yeah.
Yeah, differences are too big.
Right. And in the second act, and again, maybe this makes me somewhat unique among contemporary playwrights, I like happy endings, and I like hopeful endings.
And I think people do, too.
And I think people do, too.
As long as it's not hokey and too, you know, sentimental or it doesn't work.
Right.
Yours works very well.
Oh, thank you. And that's also what I wanted to depict, in that even though marriage is complex and marriage is a challenge, that it's still a good thing and it's still hopeful and positive, and I wanted to show how people, even when they're having their struggles and their conflicts, can ultimately connect.
And another point you make is as much as the women wanted to be liberated, in a way they took the man's role.
Sure. Somebody's got to.
Yeah. And they saw those problems. And, of course, you add to the fact that they still have to be mothers. I mean, mm-hmm. It's particularly when the kids are young but the daughter, the older daughter, or the daughter in the second part, mm-hmm. she's quite different than the daughter in the earlier part. The earlier one is this emerging feminist, and the other one, she's just worried about having a nose job, right?
Right. Well, that was also a particular challenge to portray in each act a 16-year-old girl of her time. And I'm not trying to make any blanket statements, but in the first act, she's of a earlier generation and more interested, as we were in the 60s and 70s, of being in the moment, be here now, you know, that kind of thing that I mentioned.
Sure.
And now what I find most fascinating is in the contemporary scene, the pace of life is very different. And this young woman is in a hurry. You know, she talks about, I'm going to get through high school and college and law school, boom, boom, boom. And that is the biggest difference between.
And she has it all planned out.
All planned out.
She's going to be 50 when she's 25.
Right. And that also is somewhat thanks to the woman's movement, because she's got so many more opportunities than her mother and grandmother had.
But in a way, you kind of hinted in a way, she's planning that, and that's a given. But she's sort of reversing back, because still the most important thing at the moment is a nose job.
Right.
Not the next exam or whatever.
Yeah, that's also something to explore, because for now, the next generation coming up, they have lots of choices. And this is also what we see in our culture today, that there are a lot of women who are still trying to move forward in society. And then there are also a lot of women, there are a lot of books being written now about how we should go backwards, so that women should go back to being in the home and taking care of their husbands. And that just horrifies me personally. Yeah. But that's part of what's going on.
Well, I like the way you handled the men in the play, because if anyone had left at Act One, they'd have been mad at you. They would have said, boy, they really made them, it's a male bashing show, really made the man look bad, even though you were just depicting accurately a man of that time. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of wondering, because, you know, I see so many plays, and there's a lot of male bashing plays out there, and I get a little tired of them. And I said, but I know, I don't think this guy's going to go now. He's too good a playwright. So Act Two, you show what the modern 21st century man of his time is. And it's hopeful. And you showed he's really a good guy and he really wants to make it work.
Yeah. I think ultimately they all want to make it work. You know, there are also, you know, you see probably more plays than I do, but there are so many plays out there that are about destruction and emotional violence. And that's
Amen.
Not my cup of tea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is uplifting, but it isn't, this is not, a hokey thing that you would see on, you know, Christian television. It's a mm-hmm. smart contemporary play.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And I really like what you did, because you sort of tell people, all right, we're modern. The women have made it. The men have made adjustments. Now let's redefine marriage. And what's great is you don't give the solution. You just present that let's do it. And,
right.
And so that's the hopeful ending of it. And so you like the guy, you don't hate her as the lawyer, because she's willing to make it work.
Sure.
And I think that begs another play. I think you're setting yourself up for
perhaps another 35 years from now.
Well, that could work.
Yeah.
But let's go back now into your background, because folks, let's give a little plug for the show. It's Half and Half. It's at Victory Gardens Theater on 2257 North Lincoln Avenue. What days is it showing?
We're here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday at 8, Saturday at 5 and 8:30, and Sunday at 3.
Sunday at 3.
Running currently through July 9th.
Through July 9th. And you can read a total review of it in the review section of our podcast, and that's the feature review for this week. And as I'm sure you can imagine, I really like the show. But now let's go talk about your background, because you have written how many plays now?
This is the 12th full-length play that I've written. And the 11th play that I premiered at Victory Gardens with Dennis Sakshik. So I'm so fortunate as a playwright to have this artistic home.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that's very rare. I mean, there's a few. I think Neil Simon's had some directors, and there have been a few others. But generally, you just try and market your play anywhere you can, and somebody grabs it, you go with it. And if you can, you work with them. But you have a unique situation, because you really make it a collaborative effort.
Yeah, well, and Victory Gardens is unique in its commitment to living playwrights.
Yes, they are.
I'm one of what we call the ensemble of playwrights, and there are 12 of us that have ongoing relationships with the theater. And it's just been wonderful to have this opportunity, because, as you say, most writers write something and then hope that they'll send it out in the world and somebody will pick it up. And here I've got a home where at least I know that, you know, something can be developed. And
let's talk about that, because a lot of people aren't aware of how much of a collaborative effort. I mean, they know a musical because you have so many different elements. Mm-hmm. But in a comedy or a dramatic play, you have readings. You work with a director who has a vision. You work with the actors. Tell us about that, because I know there's a lot of trust there, and there's a lot of at what point are you – will you listen? At what point are you going to make the cuts and the rewrites and, you know, that whole process? People are fascinated by that.
Yeah, that's what I teach playwriting at Columbia College and at DePaul University. And what I'm always telling my students is, you, unlike other kinds of writing, if you're a novelist or a poet or a short story writer, when those kinds of writers write something, it's for an audience of one, and you might work with an editor, but when you write something, it's basically done. Mm-hmm. As a playwright, you write something, and then you have to enter into the collaboration with the other theater artists, the director, the actors, the designers. And if you don't love that process, as I do, then you've got to find something else to do.
So, yeah,
because it's
so
much a part of it.
You can't be defensive and try and defend everywhere. I mean, I often said sometimes when I see young plays, young playwrights who start their own company, direct their own play, write their own play, inevitably, my first or second line is they should get the red pencil out.
Right. And I yearn for that. You know, I'll come up. Dennis has never told me what to write. He just occasionally will call and say, are you working on something? And once I have something to bring in, then we'll get some actors together and we'll read it. And then another thing that's great about Victory Gardens is they always have developmental workshops for new work.
Well, that's good. And so you get a chance to have a reading where professional actors try and say the words, and you'll know instantly if it doesn't work. If they get tongue-tied or the line doesn't work, it might work on paper, but it just doesn't work in the real world, right?
Sure, absolutely, because the plays aren't written to be read, they're written to be performed. And I think because I also was an actor, I understand their process. So I'm very open to any questions or concerns that they raise about the characters, about the progression of the character in the story, about particular lines, and that's all part of the development of the piece.
So you would recommend to young writers to if they can, to work with a group.
Oh, like
absolutely. Victory Gardens or Chicago Dramatists, or one of the groups that they'll nurture
or
you.
Just get together some people that you know and trust and go into somebody's living room and hear it read out loud. It's got to be heard. It's got to be performed before you really know what it is.
All right, let me ask you the hard question. When is it finished? You know, you know there's that theory of art that art is never finished. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a certain point at which, you know, your plays get published. So once they're published, that's kind of one of the...
That's a good point at which to say it's done. Yeah. But even just the other day, I got an email from somebody who is interested in doing a production of The God of Isaac, which I wrote 20 some years ago. Mm-hmm. And he asked me if I wanted to do any work on the script.
Would you consider that?
No.
No, it's totally finished.
That one's done.
Okay.
That's the
reason I asked that is Peter Schaefer still changes endings of his plays.
I've read that.
Yeah. When Walter Stearns did Amadeus, mm-hmm. he said he came in and he says he wrote yet another ending. I think he's written 4 endings since he won the Academy Award for Best Film.
Yeah.
Boy, I think I'd leave that alone.
Yeah. There have been times when in a second or third production, when something is still fresh in my mind, that I might take another look at it, get some more input from another director at another theater, and make some adjustments. So I'm always willing to hear more input. But after a certain point, like you say, particularly when it's published, not only do I feel that it's done, but I'm onto something new. I'm onto, you know, I want to get on with my life.
Yeah, right. You don't want to keep rewriting the same play.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. But like a production like Half and Half, when, I assume it's finished now.
It feels finished to me now.
Okay.
You know, after a while, I may go away from it and come back, you know, and take another look at it and get some fresh ideas.
But in the process of mounting it mm-hmm. as a world premiere, certainly in rehearsals, changes are made.
Oh, sometimes changes are made in the previews.
In the previews.
Because
you do get the feedback. Yeah, you get the feedback from the audience, too.
You get the feedback from the audience, and we pay attention to that. And Dennis Acha called the audience the great teacher. You know, particularly when you're working with a comedy, until you have that audience response, you really don't know what you have.
And that's true. You don't know if it's funny. Yeah.
It's always a surprise.
Does that scare you on opening night? What's your ritual on opening night? I mean, you know, you want to hear the laughs.
On opening night, I don't hear the laughs because I'm not even in the building.
Oh,
Tom,
okay.
Right.
I know there's a lot of theories of that.
Yeah, Dennis and I have sat through the previews and have continued to make adjustments. And then it is, you know, the hardest part for me to go through that separation.
Okay.
But I have to give it over ultimately to the actors. It's theirs. And there's a point at which I'll say, okay, I have to go do something else now.
Don't you get curious, though?
Oh, sure. I'll peek in occasionally.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Sure. You know, we do once a week, we do our post-show discussion. So that gives me an excuse to stop by.
Now, how often do you see it after, like this Half and Half, the new show?
Well, we opened, you know, just this past Monday.
Right.
So I have been seeing it a lot. And then I came by and watched it on Wednesday because we had the post-show discussion. So I wasn't in the theater last night, and I kind of missed it. So
okay.
I may come by this weekend.
And, of course, hopefully it gets a little tighter and gets a little bit more polished after it's been done.
Oh, sure. These actors are so wonderful that through the previews, and I just see how it's developing. They're on the one hand, they're settling into the roles because they understand them so well. And also things are becoming just sharper and brighter, and they're working with the audience now that they've had some experience with that. So it's just a joy to watch.
Yes, it is. All right, let's talk about some of your major accomplishments. Beau Jest is the longest running play in Victory Gardens history.
Yes.
Tell us about Beau Jest.
Beau Jest opened in 1988 here, and you know, we say some days the magic works, and that play just took off, and the production was moved to another theater. There used to be, remember the Halsted Street Theater?
Sure, sure.
You know, and so it played in Chicago for almost a year, and then it was seen by a New York producer, a wonderful man, Arthur Kanter, who opened it off-Broadway, and it ran off-Broadway for almost 3 years. So that's been my most commercially successful play, and has been done in a lot of international production, has been translated into.
So when are we going to see it again? In Chicago. Well, it's been a while now.
Yeah, it's still picked up here and there. They did a production of it at the Attic Playhouse up in Highland Park a few years ago.
Did they? Oh, yeah. Sorry, because I have not seen it. I've read it. It's very, yeah. It reads funny.
Oh, thank you. And, you know, there's also the companion piece to it called Just a Second, and that's that's done very well. Of the 12 plays that I've written now, 8 have been published. The most recent one, Affluenza, is just about to come out from Samuel.
Tell Branch. Us about that. I'll tell you, I really enjoyed that. It was all done in rhyme and in Molière style rhyme.
Right. Affluenza was indeed my homage to Molière, and particularly to Richard Wilbur, who's the famous poet who translated a lot of Molière's work. And the inspiration for that was just having seen a lot of productions of Tartuffe and Misanthrope, where the directors decide, oh, we need to update the play and set it in contemporary times to make it more relevant, and that always annoys me a little bit.
It does, and they butcher it when they. I hate when they do that. Yeah.
So I decided, well, why not write a new play in a contemporary setting, but use that style and try to accomplish some of the things through the rhyming verse that Molière was able to do, and that was quite a challenge.
I was going to say, how long did that take you to write?
Well, again, it's about a year, but. Boy, I had, you know, a rhyming dictionary and a thesaurus and a thesaurus of rhyme and every kind of reference book I could find to work, to come up with the language for that play.
Well, I don't know if you're aware of it, but one of the critics in town, Jonathan Abarbanel, wrote a review in rhyme, and it was relevant. It was almost as brilliant as the play, and I thought that was great.
Yeah, that was Jonathan being clever.
Yeah. I'll tell you, Affluenza, what made that work too was the cast. Because a lot of your rhymes, you're like, one actor will start it and the other has to finish it. So the timing, besides being, you know, a comedy, the timing has to be exquisite.
Yeah. And that was also, again, thanks to Dennis's brilliant direction, because even when he is working on a comedy, he still works with the actors to find the truth of the characters and really deal seriously with the characters' motivations and what they're trying to get from each other. And that's what actors are supposed to do, you know, whether you're working in comedy or tragedy or melodrama. So that also is another reason why these plays are so successful with the audiences.
Well, a lot of people don't realize how hard comedy is to do. Right. See, I always thought comedy was the hardest to do, and I was corrected by Paula Scarfano, who said a musical is because you got to land that song every night, even if your voice isn't good. But she says, but comedy's pretty darn hard.
That's true, too, for sure.
But, all right, so Affluenza. Give us a few of the other shows that you've done.
We're going in backwards order now, but prior to Affluenza was Door to Door, which was the play inspired by my mother's life, and it's a cast of three women covering a span of 65 years. And that play's been published, and that one is being done around the country quite a bit now. Before that, like I said, the two plays, Beau Geste and Just a Second. Romance in D was a play I did here a few years ago that's had quite a few productions. Like I said, The God of Isaac is picked up now and then. So I'm very lucky. I actually
well, let me
make
ask
a
you
living
the,
as a playwright.
This question, yeah, can you make a living as a playwright?
Well, you know.
Pretty much. I mean, you know.
It has ups and downs. Okay. Like the life of an actor, you know, that depends on knowing or not knowing when the checks are coming in, because when these plays are produced, whoever licensed the play pays a royalty, and that comes to me. So it has its ups and downs, but I'm very fortunate. This is what I always wanted to do. I still love working in the theater, and I'm very fortunate.
And you enjoy teaching too.
And I do enjoy teaching. I'm relatively new to it, but I think I just reached the age where I feel like I have some system of beliefs that I feel strongly enough that I want to pass on.
We also have a body of work.
And I have a body of work to draw on.
So if somebody says, well, how do we know you're right? Well, maybe I'm not right, but I've got 12 plays published, right?
Well, there is that. And when I do teach playwriting, I assign plays for the students to read, including Death of a Salesman, Streetcar Named Desire, and Beau Jest. Because as a teacher, I think it's important for my students to see that I practice what I preach. Okay. And it's also great for me because I don't know who first said it, but, you know, if you want to learn something, teach it to somebody else.
Yeah.
So it also gives me an opportunity to go back and really strengthen my own beliefs and attitudes about the work that we do.
Okay, well, that's true. And you're not an actor anymore?
I'm available. It's not something that I.
Why is it no
pursue.
One ever retires as an actor? Everybody that I interview who's been an actor, they always have that same answer. And I almost would have bet you would have said that.
Yeah. You know, I finally decided. I'm the youngest of three children. I'm the only one in my family that had any aspirations to go into the theater, and I have finally decided that it's just some genetic mutation that we have that makes us want to work in the
But you
theater.
Married into it too, right?
And
your wife
also,
is an actor?
Yes, and my wife and I met because she was in the original production of Beau Jest. And now my son, who's 15 and a freshman in high school, just finished the school production of Guys and Dolls. So he evidently has it in his blood too.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. We got to pass it on. We got to get the younger kids in. And I think your plays, particularly Half and Half, I think, can relate to the younger generations.
It's interesting because, and it's been very gratifying because, as you say, people that remember that time over the early 70s are particularly relating to it. But I have had some young people in the audience that are teenagers that are relating to the character of the teenager.
Oh, that's good. Well, whatever hooks them into it. Yeah. Because then they get an idea of where they're at now from where they came from.
Right.
I'm sure they hear the stories from the liberated grandmother like your Lucy character.
Yeah, and my 15-year-old son came up to me and he said, "Daddy, where did you come up with that line where the girl says?" I said, "Oh, yeah, that I got that from you." Something that he said just stuck in my mind, and I used it in the play.
Well, as a playwright, are you a note taker as a playwright? Do you sketch
constantly.
Out characters
yes.
and pick up lines?
Yes, I constantly have a pen and a piece of paper within reach, whether it's in my back pocket or in my coat pocket or in my briefcase, because I've also trained myself that if I don't write down the idea as soon as I get it, it will be gone forever because something else
I can agree with that.
Catch
yes.
my attention.
Yeah.
So I've kind of trained myself to do that. And then by the time I sit down to actually write the play, I have just, you know, notes and piles of little slips of paper where I've made little notes.
Well, what gets you to do a play? Everybody has their urge. I've had some people tell me the characters just kept speaking to me, shouting at me until I got them down on paper.
It varies. Sometimes it's a character. Sometimes it's an event. And I think because I kind of grew up loving the theater, when I do have an idea for a story, I don't think of it so much in terms of a narrative like a novelist mm-hmm. might. But I see it in my mind's eye as taking place on stage.
And so you see it as people walking around and conversing
right,
and having conflict.
And talking, yeah. And because ultimately what I'm most interested in is behavior, which is what the actors do is act. That, you know, I say to my students, we don't write for talkers and we don't write for emoters. We write for actors. Our job is to provide actions for actors to play. So
that's profound, but also I wish more of them would do that than those of us that have to see them can enjoy them.
I agree with you. So I get an image in my mind, and then it's for me a long gestation process, so that by the time, not all writers work this way, some work much more stream of consciousness, but by the time I start actually writing the play, I have an outline, and I have an idea of who the characters are and what the relationships are and what they want from each other. And I have a beginning, middle, and end. Again, because I'm an old-fashioned kind of guy, I like beginnings, middles, and ends.
Yeah, I can relate. I like that too. Yeah, you need to see you need to see the whole before you can do the parts.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. You know, this play, in even though it's related one-act plays, you see how each act takes place without any break from beginning to end. There's no break, and the action is continuous. And that's kind of old-fashioned. You know, that goes back to Aristotelian unities.
Yes, but it also is hard to maintain.
And it's hard to maintain, yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. In your writings, do you generally give a lot of stage directions or a lot of character sketches for the directors and actors to follow, or do you kind of let the directors and actors interpret?
I try to limit it. If, you know, the way I talk about stage directions are, if you're a composer and you write a piece of music, you put the notes on the page, and then every so often you might give little indications that something should be played fortissimo or piano, or something might have a crescendo or decrescendo. So those indications to the musician are, through words, the kinds of indications that I'll give to an actor in a script, that something might be with an exclamation point, or something might be said rhetorically or angrily. But I do try to limit it, because, of course, the actors are going to take the role and make it their own anyway.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And you're not constricting the creative process. You're giving the director and the actors something to play out. Well, that's profound. What's the future now for you?
Oh,
do you have another project going? Or
I only ever have one idea at a time, it seems. And, you know, we're also in an exciting time here at Victory Gardens, because we're moving to the Biograph.
Yes, yeah, that's going to be really big.
And I haven't been in there yet. You know, we're opening there in the fall.
Right.
And I have a notion about something that's going to require a larger space than we've been working in here. And I haven't told Dennis about it yet.
Oh, okay.
But that's the exciting part for the playwrights here, that we're going to have opportunities in that new space that we haven't had before. So I may.
Yeah, you can do a bigger cast show or.
Yeah, so.
How about. Have you ever considered doing a musical, or at least doing the book for one, or lyrics? Or
yes, I have. Okay. And in fact, a couple of years ago, I was rather cajoled into doing Bo Jess the musical.
Oh, you did? And, I didn't know that. Okay.
Well, very few people do. We did a workshop production of it. And the problem with it simply was, I just couldn't really convince myself that Bo Jess needed to be a musical. I did the book, which was essentially the play, and I did the lyrics, and I worked with the composer, and we came up with some fun material. And I would love to do more of that kind of work, particularly having worked on Affluenza and have, you know.
Yeah, it certainly shows. If you can do that, you can write lyrics.
And when I was younger, I used to do a fair amount of corporate writing, and I used to do a lot of song parodies. So I do enjoy writing.
Oh, so you're a Forbidden Broadway kind of guy?
Oh, sure. You know, and again.
Oh, we need some of that.
Yeah, and because of my Second City background, you know, to do the kind of satirical work is still a part of what I enjoy doing.
Well, with the new space, it sounds like
there's going to be all new possibilities.
Yeah, I could see the big smile coming up. Good. Yeah. Well, Dennis will be surprised. But we can use that, you know, the variety. But don't stop doing what you've been doing, because your comedy is terrific, and it isn't just silly. It's funny, but it also makes some very good points.
Well, thank you, Tom.
And this has been a very, very good. We've gone a little over our time, but that's okay, because you have a lot to say. Folks, make sure you see Half and Half at Victory Gardens. You're going to love it. Thank you, James, for giving me your time.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for listening to this enrapturing episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. But before we let you go, it's time for your Shakespeare Quote of the Week. The following quote has to deal with reality, and it comes from The Merchant of Venice, Act 2, Scene 7. All that glisters is not gold. Well, we can't thank you enough for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready to stick in your ears. So until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.